Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, as the international community continues to try to facilitate a peace agreement among fighters in Syria, we're joined by two experts in peacemaking. But first, we rebroadcast an interview about the man some call the most polarizing and controversial Supreme Court justice in American history, Justice Antonin Scalia, who passed away on February 13th. With us is Professor Bruce Allen Murphy, the author of Scalia, A Court of One.
Last week, we began a conversation about how U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia became what many consider the most polarizing justice on the Supreme Court, possibly in U.S. history. With us now is Bruce Allen Murphy. Bruce Allen Murphy is a judicial biographer. He is a professor of law at Lafayette College, and his latest book is Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. Last week, we discussed, judging from Justice Antonin Scalia's early life, that no one could have predicted that he would become this character that he is today. Let's start with a bit of an overview of what we discovered from last week. For example, he had never been so polarizing and so brash in his early life.
No, just the opposite, Maria. It's a pleasure to be back. What we discovered in his early life was that Scalia was a highly intellectual individual, very, very talented, able to really sort out very complex intellectual arguments, and had learned through a series of bureaucratic appointments how to use those skills to marshal the evidence to reach the result that he wanted to reach in order to serve whichever boss or whichever administrative position he happened to be working in.
He gets appointed to the appellate court, and he's still being an affable guy. He's starting to carve out his judicial theory here. We're starting to see it, but he worked well with the other side.
Generally, he did. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is a real proving ground for a Supreme Court appointment. It deals with a lot of administrative law appointments and a lot of law positions. And he was on a court in which the most visible judge in the federal system, Robert Bork, had been sitting for some time. He was more senior. He had been mentioned for the Supreme Court back in 1974. He was older than Scalia, and it was widely expected that he would get the first Reagan appointment after Sandra Day O'Connor's appointment in 1981. For Scalia, this became something of a proving ground. He did get along generally with the other members of that court. He did have his moments. He used to write and argue in cases so vehemently when he really truly believed in those issues that some of his work was called the Nino Path. And he used to tell his law clerks to work very hard to get the right result because he said it isn't easy to get right. What he was able to do was work within that system and position himself well against Robert Bork. In one case, the Ullman case, dealt with an academic from Maryland who had been accused in an opinion piece by a columnist of being a socialist and had sued for libel. And Scalia was arguing that the First Amendment, free press, did not cover such opinion pieces, did not protect the press. But Robert Bork argued, using a different sort of sociological theory, that in fact opinion pieces were given wider coverage. And that one case separated Scalia from Bork and made it appear to the Reagan administration later on that he was a more pure conservative. All in all, this became sort of an intellectual judicial pose down for Scalia, using the term of bodybuilding. He was able to show the administration that he was younger, that he was in better health, and that he was a little better conservative, and, they thought, more affable. He was able to get along with the other judges.
Let's go to the appointment process and the vetting process and all of the factors that kind of came together to make him the candidate that would then get onto the Supreme Court. So we have Jones Day, his law firm connections. We have the Italian-American bar who is trying to create the path for him to get onto the Supreme Court. What else do we have?
Well, we have a complicated vacancy situation. You have the departure of Warren Burger. So now they have to appoint a chief justice. Now, there are a couple of ways that the administration can go. They can take somebody from within the court. They can take William Rehnquist, for instance, or they can take Sandra Day O'Connor. But if they do that, it means they're opening up another vacancy that will have to be filled. or they can go off the court and take one of the number of people. And there were about a half a dozen people who had been floating around whose names were well known. Frank Winter, for instance, Robert Bork, among others, including Antonin Scalia. They could be appointed directly to the chief justiceship. Fairly early on, the president decided he was going to go from inside the court, and he decided that he was going to go with William Rehnquist. So now what you're doing is you're trading a conservative for a conservative, and they're looking to fill Rehnquist's seat. And it becomes pretty quickly a contest between Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. And there are a series of people within the Justice Department who begin looking at all of the cases, that's part of the vetting process, and trying to predict what they're going to get on the court. And they predicted that they would get a fairly consistent conservative on the court in Scalia, but they also said, you're going to get somebody who will be like the William Brennan of the conservatives. He will bring the conservatives together under William Rehnquist and will help to forge a powerful voting coalition for the Reagan administration conservatives for the next generation or so of judicial cases.
Now, you contrasted him a little bit with William Rehnquist, and it seemed to me from your book that all of his drama schooling, his great talent with drama, really paid off throughout this process.
Yes, it truly did. One of the things that he was able to do just before the appointment is he had a longstanding invitation to speak before an economic conference. He knew there would be administration officials there. He could have picked almost any of his speeches to give at that point. He had been giving for about a year a very popular speech about the problems of a legislative intent. He'd been arguing and argued successfully at that point in his career that court judges should not be trying to divine what Congress meant by the words of a statute by looking at committee hearings and by looking at the debates in Congress, that was an unreliable indicator of what the legislation actually meant. But instead, Scalia presented somewhat of a new speech and argued affably, it was a lunchtime speech, that Robert Bork had been talking about this notion of original intent, that you could figure out what the Constitution or the Bill of Rights meant by what the framers, the authors of those words, intended by those words. But Scalia said, you know, I don't think that goes far enough. I'm going to propose something called original meanings. Now, this was a term that he hadn't used in his 4 years on the district court, the Court of Appeals, rather. And it was a term that he hadn't really articulated and didn't really articulate it in that speech. He'd been using a series of other techniques, among which was textualism. I will look at the dictionary definition of the law or of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And just, I think, that sort of branding of I have a new theory, I'm different from Bork, may have helped position him just a little bit better, maybe 72 hours before the decision was made by President Reagan in the Oval Office.
It also seemed like he wasn't particularly honest in some of the questions and was able to hide this. I remember a question that you documented asked by Senator Biden, and he had essentially argued the opposite as what he said in that speech.
Well, what you have to remember about this is the nature of the politics. This is a pivotal time for the Reagan administration. Jan Crawford Greenberg has argued very persuasively in her book, Supreme Conflict, that had the Reagan administration picked Robert Bork for this first seat on the court with Rehnquist and then gone to Antonin Scalia, things would have gone better for the Rehnquist court because the Judiciary Committee and the Senate was controlled by the Republicans, and the questioner, the person leading that committee, was Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. So Scalia came into that whole process knowing, one, that the Republicans could provide cover for him, two, that the Rehnquist hearing had not gone well, and Rehnquist had a very tough time and ended up with 33 votes against him. So Scalia, I think this is what modern justices do in these confirmation hearings, found ways to finesse the issues and figure out how to get a record that would not provide objections to anybody that might cause a filibuster or some other major vote against them. The truth was, though, that the Senate by that time was exhausted and they just wanted to confirm somebody.
So from his very first case, his personality was the other one. We talked a little bit about the two different Scalias. It seems almost like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He automatically became the center of attention, monopolized the court. What happened?
Well, this is an interesting instance because political science and political scientists have gone to great lengths to write a number of really good articles and a lot of material about the judicial apprenticeship period. The theory is that when judges or appointees come to the court, they take a while to figure out what the job is. It's a very difficult job. Everybody says that it is. It's unlike anything that they've trained for. These are fantastically talented people, but they have to figure out how to work in a court of nine. They have to figure out how to work closed off from the political realm that helped them to rise to the top and get that appointment. They have to figure out how to deal with these issues that are way more complex than anything that they've seen in any previous position that they've occupied. And so usually, the theory goes, these people figure out who they should mentee to, who they should apprentice to. They figure out what position on the court, what wing on the court they should ally with, and they take a couple of years to take a breath and become a justice on the court. Scalia didn't think that was how he would do it. The fellow who arrived was not the Tony Scalia, the actor who was very affable, who the Reagan administration expected. He was the Nino Scalia, the really solid argumentation, win-it-all-cost type of person, who decided from the very first moment he was going to demonstrate that he was the equal of all the justices on the court, some of whom had been there decades longer than he had. He took over oral argument. He tried to make a point in a very minor case dealing with the inheritance of land in a Native American tribe that he had the correct theory that would solve this case. He knew the answer. And then when the case got into the conference stage and it appeared that the opinion would be written by Sandra Day O'Connor, again, there is a tradition that a maiden opinion is given to the new justice on the court. It will probably be a unanimous opinion. It's assigned by the Chief Justice. It takes a few weeks for that opinion to be assigned to the new judge, and it's usually the easy way to enter into this process. Scalia abandoned all of that and decided that he was going to take over this case. He was going to write an opinion that would try to gather up votes and steal the opinion away from Sandra Day O'Connor. And what actually happened is it took a case that probably could have been decided in a month or two, and it lasted for month after month after month. And Lewis Powell wrote on the side of one of the margins of one of the drafts of an opinion in the case, this turned out to be a very unhappy case for us. I think from that very first moment, Scalia put O'Connor on guard that he was not going to be an ally of hers, and he put Powell and some of the other senior justices on guard that he was going to be a very challenging person on the court.
If you were going to assess Scalia's impact on the court overall and on U.S. law and jurisprudence after writing this amazing tome, what would you say?
Well, I would say three things. First of all, on the question of was he able to master the politics of the court, I think the answer is no. There were instances in which he was able to get five votes and change law. He was able to help elect George Bush. He was able to help craft a Second Amendment right to bear arms. His whole approach was one of the lone wolf of the court of one. He would rather have written for himself than try to take patience and write drafts and compromise to get other justices on board. So many of his most dazzling opinions, I think, are his dissents. And those are the ones that are going to be remembered. And they may be the ones that if there's a conservative court down the road, they may be the ones that he's remembered for. That's one. Secondly, you'd have to say that his overall legacy of originalism is a substantial one. He has changed the conversation on the court. He's changed the agenda on the court. Even the liberals have to talk about originalism. But everybody's figuring out they can do whatever they want with originalism. They can pick and choose among the historical evidence. They can pick and choose which dictionaries they're going to use. They can pick and choose what definitions they're going to use. So I'm not sure that this is a process that will change the way decisions are made, but it's a process that probably will change the way decisions are explained. Thirdly, and this is, I think, one of the things that may haunt Scalia eventually. He came onto the court in 1986, and it was an institution that had largely shied away from extrajudicial works, from speeches, from writing books, from writing articles, from giving interviews off the bench, because they were still recovering from the 1969 forced resignation of Abe Fortas and the 1970 impeachment effort against William O. Douglas. Scalia set about immediately changing that standard and began giving speeches and then began roaming even more widely in those speeches until he was criticizing his colleagues, criticizing the court, changing the interpretation of the cases that had been decided that year, saying things like, the people who do not believe in my originalism theory but are living constitutionalists are the mullahs of the West, and their views are idiotic. Now, those are two different speeches that he gave those interpretations. And what it has done is it has put a partisan target on the back of the court and polarized it. And I think it's made it acceptable for people to attack the court. And when they do that kind of thing, the public support for the court has diminished. So I think that it will be a contest down the road as to whether or not the significant jurisprudential contributions of Scalia in his dissents and his originalism theory will outweigh the kind of political, partisan, foundational damage that he's done to the court in his nearly 30 years on the institution.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudi, and we're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy about the justice many believe is the most polarizing justice in U.S. history and how nobody predicted that this is who he would become when appointed to the Supreme Court. A couple of other things I wonder. One is he does seem to have had a meaningful effect on the law, particularly in his effort to incorporate religion into government.
It's true, and it depends on what side of the issue you come down on here. One of the real challenges is, does Scalia's originalism theory lead him to the correct answer on the question of religion in government? You have a debate that begins with David Souter in the Levy-Weissman case, the school prayer for graduations in Rhode Island. And the debate is whether or not Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the First Amendment intended for accommodation between church and state, or did they intend, as Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists in 1802, for a high wall of separation between church and state that became impregnable. We have to recall that the framers are deists. They are not organized religion advocates. They believe in individual prayer. And it's pretty clear, I think, from the historical record that late in their careers, both Madison and Jefferson came to understand that there should be a separation between church and state. What Scalia has been able to do in the Establishment Clause area, he's been able to work with William Rehnquist, with other conservatives, and lower that wall and make it more acceptable for the town of Greece to say, we're going to have a prayer before our town council meeting, or for people to put a giant war memorial cross on Sunrise Rock in the Mojave National Preserve. That kind of thing has happened, I think, largely in response to Scalia and the other pro-religion conservatives arguing that there should be a lowering of the wall between church and state. He was arguing in 1990, if there is a general law of the state that covers everyone, that doesn't target religion, in that case it had to do with drugs in Oregon, then even religious groups must follow it. But, he said, there might be exceptions to that in which we will use a higher level of scrutiny and protect those religious groups. This is the case in the Hobby Lobby instance, because pretty much since that 1990 case, Congress has passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Congress has passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, The Supreme Court has, in case after case after case, created new exceptions. The whole area of law has become almost like a piece of Swiss cheese, where there are more holes in which the religious groups are being protected by high level of scrutiny than there is actual cheese left of the original Scalia decision in 1990.
One area we also didn't cover is his fight with Catholicism, with one version of Catholicism, and this sect called Opus Dei. How does this all fit together?
Well, it's an interesting question. I had to look into the question of what would be the impact of the pre-Vatican II devout, conservative, traditional Catholic views of Scalia taught him by his father and by his family in the 1950s. And there is floating through the internet a series of articles and charges that perhaps Scalia is part of this very conservative group within the Catholic Church. I could find no evidence that, in fact, he was associated with that. In fact, the best source that I was able to find, John Allen, Father John Allen, said that he could find no evidence of it as well. But it raised for me a different kind of question. Scalia's gone to great lengths in a series of speeches to say it makes no difference that I'm a Catholic on the Supreme Court. I decide cases as a judge, not as a Catholic judge. There is no Catholic way to decide these cases. And he's very persuasive in making that argument from a logical standpoint. But if you look at the process that he uses of going back to original sources, of looking carefully at the meaning of the individual words, if you look at his originalism of returning to the sources, that's what Father John O'Malley uses to define what pre-Vatican II Catholicism is. They go back to a Latin-based mass. They go back to the Tridentine mass that goes back hundreds of years. And you have in Scalia a man who takes great pride in saying, the church, the modern-day church, opposes the death penalty. They want to sanctify life. That is what the modern popes are saying. But I go with the earlier millennia of popes, and I go with the eye-for-an-eye approach of the earlier Catholic Church. I am in favor of the death penalty. And so I choose to ignore the modern church and go back to the earlier church. And if you look at the social values issues that he is deciding in the death penalty, in the abortion rights area, in the gay rights area, time after time after time, his views are very consistent with what you would expect from a conservative, traditional, pre-Vatican II Catholic. And his process of using originalism to get there allows him to do it and say, I'm doing it as a judge, look at my process, it's originalism, or it just always ends up where the pre-Vatican II Catholic group would say should be their position. So maybe that's just a coincidence.
The other thing that you didn't mention about his impact on the court, I think, pertains to the decorum of the court. Would you agree?
I do. This is a real issue that I struggled with. Remember, I started my career looking at Felix Frankfurter. This is the way Frankfurter treated his colleagues. He had no trouble in criticizing his colleagues, but oftentimes he did it in letters. Oftentimes he did it in private conversation. What you see in Scalia, though, is a willingness to say things that are highly critical of his colleagues, things that would eventually drive away those moderate conservatives like Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy and David Souter, and put Scalia in the position of not being able to amass a five-vote majority. He says those things in his opinions. Very early on in the Webster case, the abortion case coming out of Missouri in 1989, Scalia wrote in a footnote that Sandra Day O'Connor's opinion was totally perverse, was irrational, and not to be believed. That kind of thing is going to have an impact. And he says these things in speeches off of the bench as well, saying of Clarence Thomas, I'm a textualist, I'm an originalist, I am not a nut. Or again, I mentioned the mullahs of the West. It was pretty clear he was also talking about his colleagues on the Supreme Court who believed in the living, evolving constitutional theory. This, I think, is unprecedented. Not even Frankfurter went this far. And it has to have an impact. You don't see the other judges doing a lot of this, but from time to time you will see creeping into their opinions an occasional word, an occasional phrase that you might not have seen in another day. The other day, in the earlier era, justices would say, my learned colleague, my brethren. They were very almost regal and polite in the way they ruled in cases. This kind of change in the etiquette and decorum of the court is something that lays at the feet of Antonin Scalia. In 1992, when Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens opposed Scalia's interpretation of history in a relatively minor property case coming out of South Carolina, Scalia overnight produced over a dozen footnotes that were highly critical of his colleagues. And they understood that this was what one of the law clerks for Harry Blackmun called the evil Nino. And they knew there would be incoming fire when they had circulated that opinion.
It is fascinating. It just seems like he was hell-bent on changing U.S. law in his own image and in his own theory, despite any of the others' perspectives. And, of course, as you said in your book, and today, really alienated his colleagues.
It's a court of nine, not a court of one. You need five votes to do anything. That's what William Brennan used to say. And from all of the epigraphs that I had for this book, and I had a dozen or more, it came down to the one that I used. Well, that's my view, and it happens to be correct. I think Scalia is absolutely certain in his view. I think he is inflexible in his view. He is not someone who's going to compromise or give in. And I think he's somewhat puzzled that people just don't agree with him because he knows he has the answer. He says, it's easy. I just look at my history and I have a result and I'm handcuffed. But somehow he's always handcuffed to that ideological right-wing partisan viewpoint that has a sort of religious tinge to it and gets him where he wants to go on the Supreme Court.
And he's so cushioned by having a Congress that is, in essence, protecting him with the ideology.
These are wonderful days for him. He's somewhat cushioned now since the appointment of Samuel Alito, changing the court significantly to the right by replacing the more moderate Sandra Day O'Connor. He's cushioned by the fact that they are voting, at least in the conservative direction. But if you look at the two cases, the abortion clinic protest case and the recess appointment case, you see what appears to be a unanimous decision. And yet, there is a concurring opinion written by Antonin Scalia in both cases that reads a little bit like a dissent. Well, you got it wrong. You didn't go far enough with these issues. You didn't get the right answer. You didn't use the proper test. Let me school you in that process. So even in winning, he's not entirely comfortable and happy. These are his significant successes. He has a court that's going in his direction, but he will not accept any compromise from what he wants to do, which is to change those legal standards and change those decisions in the time that he has remaining in the winter of his career.
Bruce Allen Murphy is the author of Scalia, A Court of One. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Maria. It was great fun.
When we come back, the real-life effective strategies for lasting peace building. Stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
The dream that people can govern themselves, that we don't need princes or popes or high mucky-mucks, priests of any kind telling us what to do and making decisions for us, is now over 200 years old. And it is extraordinary how plangent that idea still is after 200 years. All over the world, people are willing to die for that dream.
Molly Ivins, American newspaper columnist, humorist, and liberal commentator from Texas. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. The Pacifica Radio Archives celebrates Women's History Month.
When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history, and certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions.
Angela Davis, African-American civil rights activist, author and professor of the history of consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, we began a conversation about the real-life effective strategies for lasting peace building. As the international community continues to try to facilitate a peace agreement among the fighters in Syria, we're joined by two experts on peacemaking. Peter Wallenstein is Senior Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University in Sweden and Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order. Irvin Staub is with us. He is Emeritus Professor at University of Massachusetts. He's the author of Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, and the latest book, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive, Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Peter Wallenstein and Irvin Staub. It's great to talk with you both again here.
It's nice to be here again.
Very happy to be on your program.
This question of democracy. Israel, for example, is a democracy. And Irvin Staub, I'm going to direct this back to you because you talked about the destructive ideology that some people hold, and then we're talking about containing them and building around them. And yet they keep electing leaders who continue to push a sort of a destructive path that doesn't make it easy to build peace with the Palestinians. How do we reconcile this?
The problem in Israel is that there are a number of, a multiplicity of processes. One of the things about societies that have been victimized in the past, groups of people, is that they come to see the world as dangerous. They come to see others as hostile to them, and when those others are actually hostile, they can enlarge the sense of danger that these others represent. So Jews in Israel have the history of persecution in Europe, have the history of Holocaust, and have history of actual danger. When they were surrounded in 1948, the war and terrorist attacks, now the fact is that they are now much more powerful than the Palestinians. And also, the geopolitical situation have changed. The Arab countries, Sunni countries that were hostile to them in the past are now preoccupied by Iran, and they are not as hostile to them now. So they are in a much better position. But the psychology of the people can still be touched around this sensitivity to danger. So on the one hand, there is sensitivity to danger. On the other hand, there is the destructive ideology. And third, there is also just nationalism. People get carried away. In the Six-Day War, Israel did not intend to take the West Bank, but they were so successful right away at the beginning that they thought, well, we might as well go on. And once they went on, more and more they became to feel that this is ours. Partly because of the ideology, partly because they already had the territory, and so on. So you are right. They are again and again elect leaders who move them in this direction, and sometimes they frighten them. Like Netanyahu, at the time of the election, when the Arab party had many people apparently ready to vote, threatening Israelis with the Israeli Arabs taking over the country. So generating active bystandership on the part of more and more people. And that is a very demanding enterprise and very challenging. You know, I am part of a group now. I don't know whether the group is ready to talk about this, but part in the sense that email exchanges with a group of people who are starting a new initiative, which they call Save Israel, stop the occupation. The occupation is eating away both at Israel and at the Palestinians. And some of the issues is, as you suggested, electing leaders who have a different vision. When I started to work on these issues of violence between groups, initially, because everybody talked about leaders, I focused on followers, because without followers, there are no leaders. And getting followers to understand what following certain leaders might lead to can perhaps stop them to be followers. But leaders are crucial, and electing the right leaders can make all the difference, as we have seen in a number of situations now in the world. Imagine if in South Africa, instead of Nelson Mandela, there would have been a very different kind of leader. Tremendous bloodshed could have followed. So how to generate this? And there is a role of external bystanders in this, other parties, outsiders. The U.S. repeatedly have tried to bring about peace negotiations, but whenever this is challenged, the United States blinks. The presidents blink. They don't push the process. They don't have the moral courage, or what people often refer to as the political will. But imagine if a huge community of nations and their leaders came together and said, we are not going to accept this, we are not going to tolerate this. And that really, I believe, could make a significant difference.
I remember Irvin Staub over the course, beginning in the 80s, groups that had, especially these peace groups of women who had been trying to push this idea, stop the occupation, save Israel kind of a thing. But they were, their voices were really drowned out, and the violent forces shut them down violently, including the police. So it is the bystandership. You are absolutely right. It's extraordinarily difficult, particularly in an environment that's hostile to a voice of peace. Peter Wallenstein, what would you add?
We have now had almost 20 years without any agreement between Israel and PLO. I mean, the last one was in 1999. And then there was something on a roadmap in 2007. But it's been a very long period without any progress in the peace process. So, of course, that creates an dissatisfaction on both sides. And, of course, Israel is the stronger party. It is the democracy, a functioning democracy. But it has really difficulties in dealing with its own minorities. The Arab community is a big minority, and it is constantly pushed back and even used as a threat by Prime Minister Netanyahu, as Irvin said. So it is a real challenge here for Israel to demonstrate that its democracy is as good as it should be or as it would be expected to be. I think there are solutions, and it has to do with the ending of the occupation. In a book, we discussed having a two-state solution, but with two states on the same territory, so that people could choose which state to be a member of. And you would, in that sense, try to create the respect for the different communities that is needed on both sides. But it's not an easy idea, because as many ideas have already been tested, the arguments for going against these ideas are already very strong and, so to say, institutionalized. So it's very hard to move forward without really imaginative leadership.
And I do think that one thing that might begin to make a difference is if there was a unity among a number of powers in the world that says this is unacceptable. If leaders, if the President of the United States, the President of China, the Prime Minister of England, a number of people would together descend, this kind of thing is never done, would together descend on Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and also go to the Palestinian territories and say, look, you are creating destruction in the world. You are not only harming yourself now and potentially in the future, but you are likely to create problems in the world, and this must end. Now, of course, the other problem is that the world now is destructed by ISIL. And Israel, because of the changed attitude of Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Arab countries feels less threatened that way. So that's why it is important to recreate some kind of motivation among Israeli leaders to begin to take a different course.
There are also quite a few really difficult situations in the Horn of Africa and also Central Africa. And I wanted to see if we could talk about those situations. Irvin, I know you've done quite a bit of work in especially Central Africa, where Burundi is in quite a conflict right now. How can you help us understand peacemaking in that area?
You know, it's really difficult because those underlying hostilities between Hutus and Tutsis in Burundi are still there and have not been resolved. And so this president, the current president, unilaterally deciding that he wants another term contrary to the constitution creates a lot of anger, because in addition to the fact that he is assuming powers that he shouldn't have, there is the ongoing group division, and whenever one group claims more power, the other group feels greatly threatened. So it's a very difficult situation. It's interesting, if you think of it, if you compare it to Rwanda, most of us, people who have worked there and people who have looked at the situation there, have long deeply complained about the authoritarian rule of the president, Paul Kagame. And, you know, Rwanda has shown tremendous economic progress. It has shown social progress with laws that create more equality between groups. But any discussion of past history, any talk about Hutus and Tutsis is not allowed in the light of a supposedly higher ideology or principle that Rwandans are all one, we are all Rwandans, there are no divisions between us, there are no Tutsis and Hutus. But the fact is that this, a strong leader, who in many senses has been a positive leader, although doesn't allow political freedom, has managed to keep the country together without real violence. I don't know what that means, because I am still concerned about the long term, that what happens at some point in time with Hutus and Tutsis not having been able to discuss their issues, with Hutus not being able to get justice for the violence by the Tutsi army, especially in the Congo, against them. So who knows? It's a kind of an experiment. If things go on positively for a long enough time, are people able to get beyond past hurts and injuries? But, you know, in Burundi, people have been pointing to Burundi and say, and as in a positive way, and saying, well, people that can talk about Hutu and Tutsi, they can express themselves more. True, but there hasn't been comparable justice processes, partly because the violence there has been more clearly two-sided, and so things have collapsed. And I don't know. I wonder what Peter thinks about this.
Peter, would you like to comment?
I'm not really an expert on the Central African situation, but of course there is a constant connection. The borders are not as strong as you would want. And so there's constantly connection between what happens in one country and what happens in the other. So it's really what I would call a conflict complex. There are situations in the Congo that affects Rwanda, there are situations in Uganda that affects it, and the same with Burundi. So it's a very big complex, and I think one needs to deal with it in terms of a regional setting. And one of the things that have developed is this conference of the countries of the Great Lakes. And maybe that could be a framework in which one could in some way get to the dialogues and the discussions that Irvin is talking about, and that is not taking place at this time.
Part of the thing is that countries, when get into a bad cycle of relations, it often plays itself out without the international community being significantly involved. And I think that the international community should be much more significantly involved. I mean, often, this is past history, you know, long-term history, but the international community sometimes behaves so completely amazingly problematically. You know, in Rwanda at the time of the genocide, nobody did anything except countries went in to get their own nationals out of the country. Then France went in, supposedly, in order to try to stop the killing near the end, but they allowed all the genocidaires to escape into the Congo, and they set up camps there, and they received substantial humanitarian aid, and the genocidaires, the perpetrators, sold a lot of the food that they received to buy arms, and they were invading into Rwanda and killing more Tutsis. The Tutsi government there asked the international community to do something. Nobody did anything. Finally, Rwanda went into the Congo, and twice they invaded. And in the course of their invasion, they killed also a lot of Hutu civilians. And this followed by a very significant war in the Congo with a whole bunch of countries sending in armies. All of that could have been avoided in a number of ways. So, for example, when the Hutu perpetrators in those camps around the border of Rwanda were receiving humanitarian aid and they were buying arms and incursions into Rwanda, the international community could have done something. Didn't do anything. So I am talking both about things have to happen internally, but they also have to happen internationally.
Peter Wallenstein, exactly the things that you've been writing about.
Yes, and the other example you alluded to is the Horn of Africa, where you have a population of more than 100 million people tied into a whole set of conflicts where the big thing is between Ethiopia and Eritrea, which is still unsettled. You have the long-lasting conflict in Somalia that's been going on for 20 years. And now we have the very awkward situation in Sudan and South Sudan. So it's a very conflict-ridden area, and it also gets fairly little attention, and the attention it gets from the outside is, you know, what is the benefit for us to be on one of the sides here and not on the other? And again, one would like to see a sort of a broader approach, a regional approach to this conflict, and start to think which one of these should be the international community concentrate on first to see if it helps remove or create the dynamics. And to my mind, that is the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea and the border conflict, which is still not settled, although there is a peace agreement and there is a border commission that has said how the border should be drawn. If that could be removed, then you would be able to also perhaps get more concerted agreement how to deal with Sudan and also South Sudan and also Somalia. So I'm looking for a strategy where you see the key thing to do now, what is that, and then sustain that to spread to the other issues. And I imagine one could think similarly about the region of the Great Lakes.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the real-life effective strategies for lasting peace-building. Irvin Staub.
Can I just say a word about the Sudan? In the Sudan, the government uses airplanes to bomb villages in the Nuba Mountain area and other places. And there are large numbers of refugees within the country, and the government doesn't allow food to come into them. So there is constantly the danger of starvation. And as Peter said, you see, at least in the United States, you see nothing about this in the news. Every great once in a while, a columnist writes a column about it, but it is not represented in as news in the newspaper, and nobody is doing anything. President Obama, a few years ago, established an atrocity prevention commission, and this has done, from all practical purposes that one can establish, and I have tried to do that at some point, has done extremely little. So, again, the issue, the international community passively standing by, the president of the Sudan has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. It has gone to some other countries which could have arrested him because he's indicted, and that has not been done. So, you know, we live in a world where poor countries, problematic countries that don't have a well-functioning government and there are hostile groups within are trying to establish some kind of order. They do receive sometimes aid, and they also receive sometimes some support from UN missions of different kinds, but there is not enough of this. And maybe it's just too many of these things are happening, and everybody is exhausted. But even when there were fewer of these things happening, there was not international response to these things. External bystanders are often passive, and when they are active, they are not doing enough.
Yeah, and I would say they often come in too late. And then after a while, everybody realizes that and says, next time, we should be acting earlier. And it's so hard to get international action before things become serious, because it's only when it becomes serious you get the real headlines and things going. But yeah. What we would want is, of course, an early preventive action. And it is possible for us as researchers to point to the various situations where things can become very dangerous in half a year or a year, and that action now could actually be useful in order to prevent that.
That's why it's so important for leaders to understand the influences that lead to violence and the likelihood of violence. Now, people sometimes say, and I think say correctly, that if there is action taken early on and it prevents violence, then the actors don't have anything to point to create credit, because all they can claim is there is no violence. But others can say, well, maybe there would never have been violence. But in these circumstances, even if there had never been violence, effective positive actions can change the circumstances in the society and improve people's lives and the country's future.
I agree, and there should actually be a sort of Nobel Peace Prize, which is for the prevention, and those that have actually prevented, action that have prevented, should in that sense be highlighted and rewarded. And I'm pretty sure we would be able to identify such situation and say, no, here actually preventive action was taken, and it really deserves to be getting credit in order to stimulate others to act earlier.
Now, I wonder in these cases if there is a line that can be made between being accused of meddling with sovereignty, which is what the Burundian president is saying right now, but if there is a way to, like, a set of policies that would determine at what point you are not meddling but are actually being a contribution in a positive way. Peter, do you want to start, and then we'll end on this note with Irvin?
Yes, I think it is important to create conditions for a dialogue. And I agree that this is one of the arguments that will be used against any kind of stronger action. But you can have a dialogue, and you can actually do it in different ways with the use of civil society and in ways which does not impinge on the sovereignty, but still can be quite effective. So I'm in favor of creating more fora for civilian interaction. So if you have the regional body on the state level for the Great Lakes, maybe you should supplement that with a civilian setting where people can talk to each other and where the governments allow these kind of conversations. And that could be a way of reaching in to these issues and giving them a role for civil society, which I think is very much also in line with the active bystanders that Irvin is talking about. That should be allowed, and government should not be afraid of that, but instead they encourage that because it can be to the benefit of the society as a whole.
Irvin Staub?
Along the lines of what Peter is talking about, if one can work with the parties to create dialogue and can do this early enough and agree even on certain kinds of actions that can be and ought to be taken in the society, and using carrots and sometimes also threats, but carrots, saying that, you know, if certain things happen, if there are certain agreements made, if the parties agree to certain things, then certain other things will happen and the international community will make contributions, then I think a lot could happen, especially if there are respected and powerful enough external agents involved. But one must also say that people who are committed to a course of hostile action and who are not open to such discussions always potentially can say you are meddling. And meddling in those cases can be extremely important, because the fact that one engages and one starts to start things, that's very difficult, that's very challenging, and it can go very much contrary. You know, if the world points its flashlight, so to speak, on Sudan, and the media everywhere shows what's happening, and the bombings, and the civilians, and the people who are killed, and the people who are not getting food, and the people who are starving, and so on, and that's represented everywhere internationally. And then around that, many parties join together to try to take action. The president of the Sudan is almost certain to say, you are meddling. But if you want to counteract potentially violent evolutions and processes, then you have to take judicious action. And it should be humble when possible. It should be cooperative. It should be engaged with local parties. But it can also be necessary to go really contrary to what a particular leadership is doing, because they are committed to a course of destructive action.
Thank you both very much for a very important and timely discussion. Peter Wallenstein and Irvin Staub, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and wisdom and research with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Wallenstein is Senior Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University in Sweden and Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order. Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor at University of Massachusetts. He's the author of Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, and the latest book, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive, Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Heal the broken hearted, wipe away the tears, heal the soldiers' wounds and the children's fear, heal the shattered lives and tattered family ties. Oh, let the war be done. Let the peace be won right now. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won right now.